Coming up on the show today, President Biden reacts to the situation at Gaza hospitals.
So I remain somewhat hopeful, but the hospital must be protected.
Plus, the Israeli government has prepared a special movie for journalists.
What made this screening stand out was the fact that it was put together so that the Israelis were showing you the before, the during, and the after. And you could see the victims. You could see the looks on their faces.
And later, the Indonesian president visits Washington. The UK's government is upended. And we get the latest from Ukraine. Today is Tuesday, November 14th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel continued its military operations in Gaza on Tuesday, with northern Gaza showing signs of widespread destruction. And the Israeli army said it's captured Gaza's parliament and other government institutions run by Hamas in Gaza City, as its forces have deepened their offensive in the Palestinian territory. Hamas media said that 30 people were killed in a strike at the Jabalia refugee camp. The death toll could not be independently confirmed. The situation at hospitals is still grave, running perilously low on water, food, and electricity. Many hospitals have simply ceased functioning as medical centers and exist now only as buildings full of people seeking refuge. Even as Israel maintains its claim that the Shafia Hospital, Gaza's largest, sits atop a Hamas command center, President Biden said on Monday that the hospital must be protected.
You know, I have not been reluctant in expressing my concerns what's going on. And it's my hope and expectation that there will be less intrusive action relative to the hospital. We're in contact and with the Israelis. Also, there is an effort to take this pause to deal with the release of prisoners. And that's being negotiated as well with the Qataris. Engaged, and so I remain somewhat hopeful, but the hospital must be protected.
All this as people in Gaza evacuate the northern Gaza Strip by the tens of thousands. The AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The UN Humanitarian Office says another 200,000 people have fled northern Gaza in less than 10 days. Israeli ground forces have been battling Palestinian militants around hospitals in the north, where patients, newborns, and medics are stranded with no electricity and dwindling supplies. The UN says only one hospital in the north is capable of receiving patients. All the others, including Gaza's largest Shifa, which has been at the center of a days-long standoff, are no longer able to function. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, which is struggling to provide services to more than 600,000 people sheltering in the south, says it may run out of fuel by Wednesday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Amid growing calls for a ceasefire, Israelis are thinking about what happens after the fighting ends. Members of communities along the Gaza border say they want to go home, but they also want to feel safe. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Kibbutz Kfar Aza and most of the other Israeli communities bordering Gaza have become ghost towns since October 7th, when Hamas gunmen destroyed houses, killed about 1,200 Israelis, and took about 240 hostages into Gaza. Israel evacuated nearly 200,000 Israelis who were living near Gaza and resettled them in hotels and temporary housing. Most of the residents of these communities say they want to go home, but only if they are sure that what happened on October 7th can never happen again. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the only way to ensure the safety of Israeli citizens is to destroy Hamas completely and afterwards maintain Israeli security control in Gaza.
Gaza will be demilitarized, and there will no longer be a threat from the Gaza Strip to the State of Israel. And in order to ensure there will be no such threat, as long as needed, the IDF will continue to control security in the Gaza Strip to prevent terror from it.
As the civilian death toll in Gaza climbs, Israel is under growing pressure from its main ally, the United States, to do more to ease a worsening humanitarian crisis. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Far too many Palestinians have been killed. Far too many have suffered these past weeks. And we want to do everything possible to prevent harm to them and to maximize the assistance that gets to them.
While Israeli leaders do not oppose humanitarian aid for Gaza, they say there can be no ceasefire as long as 240 hostages are being held captive by Hamas. This is also a demand being made by the families of the hostages and their thousands of Israeli supporters. Analysts say a ceasefire would be a strategic mistake. Michael Oren is a former Israeli ambassador to the U.S.
The ceasefire for Israel simply means that Hamas wins, gets away with mass murder, and that Israel loses. We won't be able to restore the security to our territory, nor will we be able to restore our deterrence power in the region. Our enemies will internalize that every time they hit us, we go to defend ourselves. The international community will tie our hands with a ceasefire.
But eventually the fighting will end, and someone will have to be in charge of rebuilding Gaza and running life for its 2.3 million residents. The U.S. says it envisions that the Palestinian Authority, which now governs the West Bank, will eventually take over in Gaza. But observers say the Palestinian Authority is seen as weak and corrupt by a majority of Palestinians. Netanyahu also opposes putting the PA in charge of Gaza. Analysts say a transitional solution may be found with some kind of international governing authority. Avi Melamed is a Middle East security analyst.
It will take time until you will build a strong, valid sovereignty on the ground, a local power, because Israel basically says we don't want to rule Gaza Strip, we don't want to stay in Gaza Strip. The international community and the United States also say we don't see a reoccupation of Gaza Strip, meaning that in the end of the day, Gaza Strip has to be ruled by Palestinians, but it will take time until you will be able to recreate or encourage or support, build the scaffolders that a local power in Gaza Strip.
For now, the heavy fighting continues in Gaza with rising casualties on both sides and no end in sight. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Eilat is the southernmost city in Israel and a popular resort town on the Red Sea. It's also become one of the main hubs for evacuees from areas under fire from Hamas rockets following the October 7th attacks. Now the town has become the target of drone and missile attacks as well. VOA's Natasha Mozgovaya reports.
When sirens warn of a rocket attack, residents of Eilat in southern Israel have about 30 seconds to get a shelter. But before a drone crashed into a school last week, there was no siren, just a whirring noise followed by an explosion. Twelve-year-old Gal Harari says most students had already left the building, with about 40 inside for after-school activities. She recalls the day of the drone attack, saying, "We were preparing in the past few days, we had a lot of drills, so the students knew what to do. We were lucky that nobody got hurt. It was a real miracle." The drone, which Israel Defense Forces say came from Syria, damaged the building. There were no injuries. The Israeli resort city of Eilat was supposed to become a safe shelter for over 60,000 people evacuated from towns and villages in southern Israel that were under rocket attacks from Gaza. Yet this city became the target of ballistic missiles fired by Houthi rebels from Yemen and also drones launched from Syria. One of those drones crashed into the elementary school building. Gal's mother, Sharon Harari, says she used to tell her daughter the school is the safest place because their family home doesn't have a shelter. Sharon Harari says, "I really thought it was the safest place and that the girls need to go to their routine of studies alongside the war and continue their lives. But unfortunately, it didn't happen because there was no siren and no alert. And if this happened, anything could happen." She says the conflict is taking its toll on the children. Sharon Harari says even when the kid is not physically hurt, he's psychologically hurt. And the kids here of all ages are scared. They don't sleep at night, they're afraid to go to the restroom by themselves, they're not going to play outside. Even though it looks pastoral with the sea and everything, it's all very pretty and we're trying hard, we are scared.
אנחנו באמת מנסים, אבל אנחנו מפוחדים.
Last week, the Israel Defense Forces said its long-range Arrow air defense system intercepted a surface-to-surface missile over the Red Sea, launched toward Eilat. The IDF did not say who was behind the missile, although Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels claimed firing ballistic missiles toward southern Israel. Darin Ray's family is among the survivors of the October 7 attack on kibbutz near Oz by Hamas, a U.S.-designated terror organization. One-fourth of the community of 400 were among the victims. At least 20 people were killed and more than 70 kidnapped. She says Hamas was inside her family's home, but couldn't break into the fortified room where she, her husband, and their three kids were hiding, holding the door for 8 hours. The family evacuated to Eilat, which now is being targeted. For the surviving Near Oz members, it will be years before they can return to their kibbutz if they decide to.
There is a plan that we go together to some place with buildings, that it's very different from our life, just for 2 or 3 years. And in the end, we're supposed to come back to the kibbutz after they will fix everything and make it renew. I don't know if I come back. Actually, I want to say that I don't come back because my kids are very scared. And also, my husband, we promised them all of their life, don't be scared. The soldiers is here. They're working as very hard for us and they will never let something happen.
On October 7th, she says, nobody came. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Eilat, Israel.
The Israeli government has been showing a special movie to journalists over the past few weeks. It's a compilation of Hamas body cam footage and security camera footage that shows the bloody events of October 7th as they happened. The acts depicted are heinous. Stabbings, beheadings, sexual assaults, dismemberment, and more. The video shows the killing of unarmed civilians, women, and children. The video is a clear attempt by the Israeli government to show the brutality of the October 7th attacks to demonstrate what they think this war is for and why, in the Israeli government's view, Hamas must be eliminated. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden saw that video. He joins me on the phone to talk about it.
What made this screening stand out was the fact that it was put together so that the Israelis were showing you the before, the during, and the after. And you could see the victims. You could see the looks on their faces as they realized that they were coming under attack. You could see the Hamas terrorists who are carrying out this attack as they're going around, walking around the various kibbutzim, the various communities, the music festival, looking for people and shooting them as they fled. And you could see their reactions. And then you could see the aftermath when the first responders, the medics, finally arrived and saw the aftermath of the attacks. And it was 45 minutes of nonstop of these views, time and time again. As far as the audience, there were times when people had to get up and walk out. There were times when people just were sobbing because it was tough to see as Israel showed the totality of these attacks. And for 45 minutes, they said they only showed you the deaths of 138 people. And of course, at least about 1,200 Israeli civilians are thought to have been killed in the October 7th attack.
Now, Jeff, clearly one of the motivations behind the Israeli government's showing of this film to journalists is to give journalists more background, more context on what happened so that it might mitigate some of the criticism on what's happening to civilians in Gaza. Do you think that message got across? Did it work?
You know, as journalists, we've seen atrocities before. As a correspondent who's had to cover the U.S. response to Al-Qaeda, to ISIS in Iraq and Syria, we've seen too many of these videos where it's terrorism. And essentially, what we're seeing in this video that the Israelis showed us is terrorism. It's a terrorist attack. The targets vastly were civilians, often unarmed civilians. There's one scene that stood out to me because they showed a group of Israeli soldiers, confirmed IDF soldiers, who we later saw had been massacred. But they were 18, 19, 20-year-old girls. None of them were in uniform at the time. None of them were armed. and they were killed. So does it give you some perspective? Yes, it does. At the same time, though, what you see here, does it have a bearing on what's happening to civilians in Gaza? You know, what's terrible, you know, from a human perspective, if it's terrible, it's terrible. And, if it's a civilian who's being killed, it's a civilian that's being killed. If their goal is to switch that, it's not something I can say whether or not it works. It does give you a better sense of what happened at that time on that day. And I think from the Israeli officials I was able to talk to, their rationale for showing it was more to show that what Hamas did was not a legitimate military operation. It was, in fact, a terrorist attack that targeted, by and large, unarmed civilians who were fleeing from their lives and posed absolutely no threat to the armed Hamas militants who had infiltrated Israel.
Jeff Seldon is VOA's national security correspondent. Jeff, thanks for your reporting on this. Thanks for your time.
Anytime.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish. An update from Kyiv in a few minutes. Now, though, a look at diplomatic forces around the world and how they're reacting or adapting to the situation in the Middle East. Beginning with Indonesian President Joko Widodo, leader of the most populous Muslim country, he met with President Joe Biden at the White House on Monday, and he delivered an appeal from 57 countries of the Muslim world for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
As Israel expands its ground operation and continues airstrikes in Gaza, a message for President Biden from 57 Arab and Muslim countries delivered by Indonesian President Joko Widodo at the White House Monday.
Indonesia appeal to the U.S. to do more to stop the atrocities in Gaza. This fire is a must for the sake of humanity.
Widodo presented a resolution from the emergency summit of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia this weekend. It rejected Israel's justification of its actions in Gaza as self-defense and demanded an immediate end to the war. It called for a halt to the sale of arms to Israel and increased access for humanitarian aid. Biden named a list of common interests, including building a resilient supply chain on critical minerals. Indonesia has the world's largest reserves of nickel and is keen to enter the U.S. EV battery industry. Also, clean energy transition to combat the climate crisis and maritime security cooperation.
We're talking about taking our relationship to launching the highest possible level of cooperation.
Hari ini kita meningkatkan hubungan kita ke tingkat tertinggi dengan berbicara mengenai kemitraan yang tertinggi.
Comprehensive strategic partnership.
Biden did not mention Gaza, where more than 11,000 have died under Israeli strikes since the Hamas October 7 attack. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
On many issues, they will agree wholeheartedly. In fact, they'll make significant progress. On other issues, they will have different perspectives. President Widodo's position on the conflict in Gaza is well known. So is President Biden's. They'll both have the opportunity to respectfully exchange views on that issue.
After his Washington stop, Widodo heads to San Francisco for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit hosted by the U.S. Biden is set to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the APEC summit. Officials said Biden is keen to use discussions with Widodo to inform him on regional views on Beijing. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News at the White House.
And now to the UK, where former Prime Minister David Cameron has made a surprise return to government as the country's foreign secretary. This after a cabinet reorganization following Suella Braverman, the former Home Secretary's departure, and a chaotic weekend in the British capital. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
7 years after quitting as Prime Minister after losing the referendum on leaving the European Union, former Prime Minister Minister David Cameron is back in government, chosen as Foreign Secretary following a government reshuffle Monday.
It's a time where we have some daunting challenges as a country, the conflict in the Middle East, the war in Ukraine.
The war in Gaza rages on. As Prime Minister in 2010, Cameron called the Palestinian Gaza Strip a prison camp, although he maintained Britain's close alliance with Israel. Chatham House's Bronwyn Maddox.
In the Middle East, some of the conflicts have not changed. David Cameron is remembered for the intervention in Libya, which was not the greatest success.
King's College's Anand Menon says Britain's foreign policy is unlikely to change.
I think this is largely signalling to a domestic audience.
Cameron replaces James Cleverly, who moves to the role of Home Secretary in place of Suella Braverman, who was sacked Monday. That followed a newspaper article in which she accused Britain's police of showing left-wing bias towards pro-Palestinian demonstrations, which she described as hate marches. The article had not been approved by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. At least 300,000 people joined a pro-Palestinian protest in London Saturday, calling for a ceasefire. There were violent far-right counter-demonstrations, and police made at least 120 arrests. Reports of anti-Semitic and Islamophobic attacks have risen sharply since the Israel-Hamas conflict broke out.
It reinforces existing party divisions, which I think makes it more likely that this kind of thing will explode amongst party political lines. But I think with Israel-Gaza, you see it in a particularly acute form, particularly as well, of course, given the high levels of violence from both sides that we've seen during this awful war.
Analysts say the Prime Minister's reshuffle is an effort to broaden his Conservative Party's appeal, as it lags far behind the opposition Labour Party in the polls, with an election due before the end of next year. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And finally today, the latest updates from the Russia-Ukraine battlefield show that Ukrainian forces have had partial success in the Kherson region on the left bank of the Dnipro River, while Russian forces advance in the east towards Avdiivka. Anna Chernikova has the details.
Before dawn on November 14th, the Russian forces launched 9 drones and 2 missiles over Ukraine. Ukrainian air forces confirmed the destruction of 7 of the drones. Russians launched the drones from the Krasnodar region in Russia. The missiles came from Russian-occupied positions in Crimea and aircraft over occupied Zaporizhia. On Monday, Russian troops continued their offensive in and around Avdiivka in the Donetsk region. The Institute for the Study of War confirmed the success of Russian forces in that area on Tuesday. Geolocated video footage released earlier also demonstrated that Russian troops have advanced to the eastern outskirts of the village of Stepova, which is 3 kilometers north of Avdiivka. At the same time, the General Staff of Ukraine reported that Russian troops carried out unsuccessful attacks in areas surrounding Avdiivka. VOA cannot verify this information independently at this time. The Ukrainian military confirms that the fight is very intense in the eastern front line and Ukrainian forces have partial success keeping their defense positions. Meanwhile, Russian sources claim that Ukrainian forces continued ground operations on the eastern left bank of the Dnipro River in the Kherson region and had made small advances. Russian media bloggers claimed that Ukrainian troops were holding positions in the village of Krynki, which is 30 kilometers northeast of the Kherson region and 2 kilometers from the Dnipro River, and had slightly expanded the control zone in the south. Ukrainian authorities did not comment on these claims, as they rarely comment on the actions that remain in progress. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And that's going to wrap up today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.